Well, if you would turn with me to Genesis chapter 15. We're continuing our series in the book of Genesis. We're in Genesis chapter 15. We're going to begin in verse 1. It says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." Well, our text begins with the words, "after these things." Apparently, the author thinks what happened before that was very important. And so he, even though it just happened in the text, he reminds his readers, hey, this just happened. After that happened, then this next thing happened. So what are these things? What is he drawing our attention to? Well, last week we looked at the story of the four kings. There were four kings who got angry that some other kings who had been paying them off stopped paying them off. And so they went on this invasion. They invaded the land God had promised to give to Abram. They captured a bunch of cities. And finally, they captured the city of Sodom and Abram's nephew Lot. And they take the people and all the treasure and they head back home. So Abram gathers a small army. He chases after these kings, and God gives him an incredible victory. Even though it's a small army, God gives him an overwhelming victory against these four kings, and he is able to rescue all of the people who had been taken, including Lot. Now, Abram immediately becomes a great hero. He's a man of great fame. With a small army and a brilliant military strategy, he defeats these kings who had demonstrated great power, captured lots of cities, had a much larger army than Abram had. In fact, Abram was able to chase these kings hundreds of miles away to make sure that they would never again invade the land that God had promised him. See, Abram isn't just a man anymore. Now Abram is the man. People know who he is. After these things happened, God appears to Abram in a vision. And the first words that God speaks to Abram are, "Fear not." Why would God tell Abram to not be afraid right after Abram demonstrates incredible courage in this battle? Because oftentimes our weakest moments occur right after a great victory. You know, the prophet Elijah once stood on Mount Carmel facing down 400 prophets of Baal all by himself. The next thing he knew, he was running because some woman was angry with him. After a great victory that God gives us, it's easy for us. We often find ourselves in our weakest point. And so God speaks to Abram, and he encourages Abram to remain faithful, even though Abram had already demonstrated great faith in God. God tells him to not be afraid because God is his shield. That is, God is the one who is protecting Abram. And then he tells Abram that Abram's reward is going to be very great. Now keep in mind, Abram was already rich. God had blessed him in this way. Even though at the end of the battle, Abram refused to keep any of the treasure, and it was an incredible treasure, the wealth of countless cities and people that had been taken from them. Even though he refused that, he was still already a very wealthy man. And yet God says Abram is going to receive a great reward. Abram, however, is not satisfied with God's promise. Verse 2. But Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir." Now, Abram is a great man, just as God promised him. Abram was a blessing to other people, just as God promised him. Those who blessed Abram were being blessed. Those who cursed Abram, like these four kings, were being cursed, just as God promised. Yet when God told Abram that he would receive a great reward, Abram responds with a question. "What could you possibly give me, God, since you haven't even given me a son?" Now, there are other promises that God made to Abram. He promised him lots of descendants. He'd be the father of a great nation. That would require children. You can't give birth to a great nation if you don't have children. But he also promised him land, and that would require taking the land from the people who are already living there. You've got to remember, at this point in his life, Abram's already middle-aged. Now, he lives much longer than you and I are going to live, but he's not going to live hundreds and hundreds of years like the people before the flood. Abram knows his time is limited. He only has so much time left on earth to actually receive these promises, and he frankly can't see any way for that to happen. Well, God promises this reward to Abram, but Abram responds by asking God what he could possibly give him since he doesn't have a son. Now, Abram's not being disrespectful here. He is not dishonoring God by asking a question. The fact is, God is not afraid of our questions. Abram has a legitimate question. God could give him 10 times as much wealth, but what does it matter if all of that wealth that God blesses him with goes to one of his servants when he dies? So he asks a legitimate question. God, what more could you give me? Well, God's response to him is quite profound. Verse 4. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man, he doesn't even name him, this man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Now, Abram asks God what God could give him since he hadn't given him a son. God responds by telling Abram, he will have a son. That's what more I can do for you. I can give you what I said I would give you. Now, he doesn't just give Abram an answer. He shows Abram the answer. He takes him outside. He's probably in the tent. Takes him outside and says, look up. I don't know if you've ever been outside on a cloudless night away from a city, but the view is spectacular. Years ago, my family, we visited friends in Colorado. They lived on an eastern slope of a mountain, very dry area, no clouds at all in the sky. At night, it was away from the city. They lived way out in the middle of nothing. At night, the view of the stars was, it was stunning. I didn't know there were that many stars up there. Certainly can't see it from Grand Rapids. There's too much ambient light blocking our view. God takes him outside, away from, there's no city street lights or anything going on here. Abram has an amazing view of the sky. And God says, go ahead and count them. That's how many offspring you're going to have. Of course, he cannot count them. God simply tells Abram that he's going to give Abram so many children that he won't be able to keep track of them. And God doesn't offer Abram any proof beyond, because I said so. Verse 6. And he believed the Lord, and he, the Lord, counted it to him as righteousness. God told Abram what he would do, and Abram believed him. See, Abram here is trusting in God's character. He's trusting in who God is. He's trusting in God's power. God is not the sort of person who would lie, and so if he tells Abram it's going to be so, it's going to be so. Abram's trusting in God and in his word. The fact is, we trust God because God is trustworthy. That means we can trust God with our lives. We can trust God with our money. We can trust God with our relationships. We can trust God with our singleness. Did you catch the result of Abram's faith, though? Verse 6 is one of the most important verses in the entire Bible. Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord credited his faith to him as righteousness. What made Abram righteous wasn't his incredible character. We've already seen that he's willing to lie, and not just lie to protect his skin. He's willing to put his wife at great risk in order to protect his skin. He's hardly a great man of integrity that we would of any measure of integrity we would have. What made Abram righteous wasn't his lifetime of faithfulness to God. Remember, a large portion of his life was spent in Ur worshiping false idols before God appeared to him and called him out of Ur. What made Abram righteous was his faith in God. And there's no elaborate ritual Abram goes through. There's no special prayer. There's no certain act he had to do in order to be righteous. He simply believed what God said. And because he believed what God said, God counted his faith in God as righteousness, as if Abram were perfect in his sight. Now we're looking here at God's response to Abram's question. He asked what God could give him since he was childless. God told Abram that he will give him lots of descendants. But there's more. Verse 7. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. Here God is revealing who he is and what he has done. Abram asks what God will give him, and God tells him he'll give him lots of descendants and he will give him lots of land. Now keep in mind that the author has already revealed Abram's faith. Abram is a man of faith. He believes God. God says it. Abram believes it. There's no question in his mind that God is able and that God is willing. Abram believes what God says. That's what verse 6 tells us. But Abram has the question again. Verse 8. But he said, O Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it? But God gives him this promise, and Abram recognizes this is an incredible thing. This is no mere, hey, I'll give you $5. This is a big promise. He can understand how God would give him a child. I mean, he's married. He knows how it happens. He doesn't know how, why it hasn't happened, but he's going to remain faithful and living with his wife as husband and wife, and eventually through the normal act of marriage, God is somehow going to miraculously give them a child. He can conceive, no pun intended, he can conceive in his mind how it will be that God will bring him a child. But the land, how are you going to give me the land, Lord? There's lots of people here. Even though Abram was very successful against the four kings, the fact is he remains a shepherd who lives in a tent on a rental lot. Abram doesn't own any property here. He doesn't see any clear pathway to owning the land God promised to give him. And so he asks, God, how about it? How can I know that you're actually going to do this? Now we have to distinguish here between asking God a question and accusing God. Abram is asking for evidence. He's asking from a position of faith. We see that. He's asking from a position of faith, as we saw in verse 6. He is no skeptic who is doubting God at every turn. He believes God, but he needs something practical that will set his mind at ease. He's really wanting to know how God will give him the land when there doesn't seem to be any way for this to happen. Remember, God is not afraid of our questions. There's nothing wrong with asking questions. Questions that come from faith, not from defiance. Lots of people question God out of defiance rather than faith. In fact, there are things in the Bible I don't understand. I don't know how certain things happen or why they happen or how that works with all these other things. But when we ask questions from faith, we're not asking questions that are really accusations of God. See, a skeptic without faith would ask God or say to God, prove it. Prove it. But Abram isn't asking for proof. He's asking for evidence for what he already believes to be true, and he believes it to be true simply because God said it was true. The reality is, Abram has weak faith. He's not lacking faith, but it is a weak faith. Like when he went to Egypt, he didn't lack faith in Egypt, but his faith was so weak he didn't see how God could protect both he and his wife, and so he lied about it, thus putting her in more danger. Abram's like the man in Mark 9. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Well, God makes this amazing promise to him, and Abram believes God. He trusts God, but he also recognizes his faith is weak, and he cannot see the way for God to fulfill it. So he asks for a way to know that God will actually do what he says. Well, God is good, and he's loving, and he's kind, and he's merciful, and he's patient. And so out of his patience, he answers Abram. Now, as an aside, this is why we spend so much time at New City talking about God's character. I know this might be strange to some, but the Bible's not actually about us. It involves us, but the Bible is not actually about us. So when we talk about the Bible, we're really talking about God, because the Bible is the written record of the revelation of who God is, ultimately, finally, in Jesus. We're involved in the story, but the story of the Bible isn't about us. It's about God. It's about his character. You know, there have been times in my life where the only thing I could cling to was God's character. I've been homeless. I've been jobless. I've been so broke I couldn't buy diapers for my children. You know what kept me going through all of that? God. Specifically, God's character. The fact that God can be trusted even when my circumstances seem to suggest that he cannot be. Despite the circumstances, we cling to God. It's God's character that gives us hope. And God's character is what leads him to answer Abram's question in verse 9. He, God, said to Abram, bring me a heifer, a cow, 3 years old, a female goat, 3 years old, a ram, 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought him all these, cut them in half, and laid each half over against the other. But he did not cut the birds in half. And when the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. Now imagine you're in the situation, right? God has appeared to you. He speaks to you. He gives you this great, incredible promise that is so big you can't imagine how it could actually become true. And so you say, God, how can I know that this is going to happen? What can you tell me? What kind of evidence can you give me that would show me that this is really going to take place? You believe with all your heart that it's true. You're not questioning whether God's a liar. You believe him. You trust his character. But you know your faith is weak and you need something to strengthen your faith. And you say, how can I know? And so God says, hey, sure thing. I can. Here's the evidence. You ready? Go get these animals. Makes sense, doesn't it? Well, it made sense to Abram. you see his response. Abram knows exactly what to do. Not only does he go get the animals, but he kills them. And then he cuts them in half, except for the birds. He's got two birds. He takes the halves of the animal, and he lines up half in a row here and half in a row here, one bird at each end. There's a path to walk in between them. Abram understands what's going on. He asks God how he can know, and God responds with a covenant ceremony. They're going to cut a covenant together. Now, a covenant is an unbreakable promise. In a covenant-cutting ceremony, animals were often sacrificed. They were cut in half. They were lined up in a row. The two persons in the covenant would walk in between them, and they would recite their responsibilities in the covenant. For example, if there was a king who's got a guy who's not really part of his kingdom, he's on the edge of his territory, he goes to a wealthy man, he goes to him and says, "Hey, I want to make a covenant with you." Now, the king has an army behind him, so you can't really say no. But you say, "Here's the covenant. I will protect you." The king says, "I will protect you against foreign invaders. Anyone who wants to come in and steal your livestock, I'll protect your livestock. Anyone who wants to kick you off your land and try to take over, I'll protect you. But here's what you're going to do for me. You're going to pay me taxes, and you're going to fight for me, whether it's you or you send some servants. You're going to fight in my army anytime I call on you and say, 'Hey, I need an army.' You have to keep your end of the bargain in order for me to keep my end of the bargain." Then both of them, the king and this wealthy man, would walk in between the two halves, and each would recite their responsibilities. "I will do this if you will also do this." Now, the message is clear as they're walking between the two animal halves. What each person is saying is, "I would rather end up chopped up and butchered like these animals than break my promise to you." You know, the closest thing we have in our culture to a real covenant is marriage, but even marriage is unbreakable, or is very breakable. But the idea behind it is that it was unbreakable. That's how God intended it from the beginning. So both parties make these promises. All that remains for the ceremony is for Abram to hear what his responsibilities are, and then as he walks through and then God walks through in between these halves, they will each hear what the responsibilities are. So Abram is waiting for this. God is going to let him know how Abram can know that God will do this through this covenant-cutting ceremony. But the answer doesn't come quite the way Abram expected it to. Verse 12. "As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him." Now, Abram's from Mesopotamia. That's where Ur was, in the region called Mesopotamia. He understands this covenant-cutting ceremony. It was common in that day. But before Abram can walk in between the two halves of the animals and recite his responsibilities for fulfilling the covenant, God causes him to fall asleep. God brings this dreadful darkness over him. Abram is unable to move, therefore unable to not only walk between them, but unable to speak and recite his responsibilities for this covenant. It's a frightening experience for him. This dreadful darkness comes over him. The fact is, God is coming to Abram. God's presence is not a thing we enter into casually. It is a frightening thing, for God is holy and we are not. Abram recognizes this danger because he recognizes God is holy. See, God is not going to enter into this covenant with him lightly. God is not going to obligate himself to Abram in any way lightly. There is a weightiness to this. It's too serious. It's too significant. Despite the gravity of the situation, Abram's unable to stay awake. God causes a deep sleep to come upon him, and he cannot walk between the halves of the animals. Now, there's a reason God does this, as we're going to see in a few moments. We're in verse 13. "Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" Imagine Abram's shock here. "God, how can I know that you're going to give me this land?" Here's how. "Know for certain that your offspring won't live here for 400 years. Instead, they're going to be captives in another land, and they're going to be enslaved, and they're going to live lives of incredible pain and anguish. But don't worry, after 400 years of that, I'll bring them back. And they'll come back and they'll be wealthy. They will have all kinds of prosperity when they come out of the land that oppresses them. But don't worry, Abram. It's not going to happen in your lifetime. In fact, you're going to go to the grave in peace. You're not going to experience any of this hardship." Well, God says something very curious here. He says he'll bring Abram's descendants back in the fourth generation. Now, in Abram's day, a generation was viewed to be about 100 years, so about 400. Turns out it's 430. It's a round number, about 400 years. But do you see the reason God is going to wait four generations, 400 years? He says the sin of the Amorites isn't ready for judgment yet. Who are the Amorites? The Amorites are a group of people living in the land that God had promised Abram. If Abram's going to occupy the land and own it, they got to go. Now, most scholars believe that the group of Amorites are a synecdoche. There's a big seminary word for you. A synecdoche, it's the part that represents the whole. Right? You keep your eye from sin. It's not your eye that's sinning, it's your whole body, but you use the part to represent the whole. God, the Amorites represent all the people of the land. He says, the people of the land aren't quite sinful enough for me to bring whole national judgment upon them. So we're going to wait 400 years. I've got to get your people out of here for 400 years. Their sin is going to grow and grow and grow. And when the time is ripe to judge them, I'm going to rescue your descendants out of the land that oppresses them. And you're going to come in here and you're going to judge them. I'm going to use you to judge the people of the land by kicking them out of the land. If Abram ever doubted that God was sovereign over all things, that is, God is in control over all things, including human history, this should erase that doubt. Abram asks how he can know that God will do this, and God tells him that he is going to direct human history in such a way that he's going to be able to bring about he's going to move entire nations around so that he can fulfill his promises to Abram. Now, he doesn't tell Abram where the land is. He doesn't tell him who the oppressors are or how it is that his descendants will end up in that land. But he does reassure Abram that he has it all mapped out. He's got at least the next four centuries locked up. He knows exactly how it's going to come about. But this covenant-cutting ceremony isn't finished yet. There are some responsibilities to be handed out. Verse 17. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. That's God's responsibility. Where's Abram? He's sleeping. Abram cannot get up and pass between the halves and recite any responsibilities to fulfill this covenant because God has made him sleep. God is preventing him from walking in between these halves. Instead of Abram going in between, there's a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch. Those were both common symbols, representations of God's physical presence. God passes in between the two animal halves, and God recites his responsibilities. In a typical covenant-cutting ceremony, both parties would pass through, and both parties would recite their responsibilities. But God prevents Abram from doing this. See, God will give this land to Abram. Abram has responsibilities. We've seen them. Abram must believe. That's why the author has pointed out that Abram was already believing. Abram is already a man of faith. Abram must protect his family. That's the whole bit about chasing away the birds of prey. It was symbolic of Abram protecting his family, just as he did with Lot. Abram must have a child with his wife, and through the usual way, they're not going to just have a baby appear out of heaven. Abram must continue to pursue his wife in the act of marriage, even though, as we're going to see in later chapters, she's going to be long past menopause, long past the time that a woman can have a child. Abram's still going to remain faithful in this way. However, despite Abram's very necessary, very real involvement in fulfilling the covenant, the final, ultimate responsibility for God giving the land to Abram lies with God. God assumes all the responsibility for it. And as with any covenant-cutting ceremony, the participants here declare that they would rather die than to fail to do what they promised. Abram asks God how he can know that God would give him the land, and God says that he responds by showing Abram that God would rather die than break his promise. Despite what life brings us, we can trust God because we can trust his character. When God makes a promise to Abram, all Abram needs is God's word. God says it and Abram believes it. He believes because God says it so. He asks for confirmation of his faith, and God gives it to him. But you see what the confirmation actually is here. There's no collateral offered to Abram. God doesn't say, hold on to this in case I don't keep my promise. There's no collateral offered. follow the sequence with me. God promises lots of children to Abram. Abram believes God, that God would give him lots of descendants. God promised to give land to Abram. God says he'll give land. He asks for evidence. God offers him evidence. And the evidence he offered him is a covenant. But do you see what the evidence really is? He cut this covenant, but what God is really saying is God is going to give him the land. It's going to take 400 years, but God is going to do it. Do you see the evidence? God, how can I know that you're actually going to do what you say you're going to do? Here's how you can know, Abram. Here's how you can know for certain that I'm going to do it. I will give you the land. That's it. That's the evidence. God says he will do it. That's the evidence Abram is looking for. If you say it, God, I will believe it. God says, know for certain that I will give it to you. It's going to take 400 years, plus that your descendants are going to suffer for a long time. But know for certain that I will do it because I'm telling you I will do it. The evidence God offers Abram is just his word. He obligates himself to do for Abram what he had already promised to do for Abram. The evidence is nothing more than God's character here. Here's how the author of Hebrews put it. For when God made a promise to Abraham, Abram will soon be renamed Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. So that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. When God made his promises to Abram, he swore by himself. There was no one greater to swear to. I mean, we've all heard someone say, I swear to God it's true. Or I'll swear on a stack of Bibles. When you take an oath in a courtroom, you are swearing with the entire government, ensuring that you're not lying, because there are serious consequences to lying under oath to the government. There's no one that God can swear to. So he swears to himself. I swear, I promise that I will actually do this. And notice at the end of verse 17, he says that God guaranteed it with an oath, beginning of verse 18, so that by two unchangeable things, what two unchangeable things? His promise and his oath. They are unchangeable because it is impossible for God to lie. It is against his nature to lie. He is not the lying sort, so he is incapable of violating his own character. God makes this oath based simply because he said so. His word is his promise. When God cuts a covenant with Abram, he's not making his promise any more sure to be fulfilled. It's not, oh, now you made a covenant, now I know. He simply says, I will do this. The covenant is simply so that Abram can see that God will do it. The covenant isn't for God to, you know, really get committed to fulfilling it. The covenant is so Abram can see how committed God is to fulfilling his covenant, his promises. When God speaks, his word is rock solid and it can be trusted whether he cuts a covenant or not. Because when God cuts the covenant, he's simply saying that he will do what he says he will do. See, when God makes a promise to us, he cannot make that promise any more sure than it already is because his promises are based entirely on his character. You can trust his word because you can trust him. See, a lot of people approach God with a show me, then I will trust you attitude. Give me proof because I don't really believe you, God. God, you promised to never leave me nor forsake me. So prove that you haven't left me by taking away my depressive feelings. And then I will follow you. But God, you promised that you would provide for me, but I still don't have a job. Give me a job, and then I'll believe that you're trustworthy. God, take away these sinful desires. Then I'll get committed and follow you. God, if you give me a wife or if you give me a husband, then I promise to trust you and be the man or be the woman you created me to be. But you've got to give me that first. God, take away these sinful desires. God, show me the medical report. Show me that I'm healed, and then I'll believe that you can heal me. Then I'll follow you. How many times have you heard someone in distress, like, God, if you can get me out of this situation, I'll do whatever you ask. It's the wrong way to approach God. God, I will do whatever you ask, whether you get me out of the situation I created or not. Because you are worthy of following. You are worthy of trust. We must ask, we can ask God for evidence, but that must be to, in order to strengthen our faith. We must believe God even when all we have is His word of promise. If we ask God for evidence, we must make sure we are asking in faith, that we believe, we trust, but our faith is weak and we recognize that, God, can you give me something? I'm losing it here. I need you to strengthen, sustain my faith so that I can remain faithful. We trust God, though, not His evidence, and we must be willing to act on what God says. Abram was willing to act on God's promises. He promised him a son, and so he'd remain with his wife long past the time of age, the age that she could have children. He was willing to act on God's promises. God can be trusted, and so trusting Him requires that we act in faith. We have to trust God because He's trustworthy and not because of our circumstances. Our circumstances cannot determine whether God is trustworthy, whether God fulfills His promise immediately or He waits 400 years. The reason we can trust Him is because His character is trustworthy. As we saw in chapter 12, the greatest promise that God made to Abram was to bless all the families of the earth through him. The reality is it's going to take God thousands of years to truly fulfill this promise. He is still in the act of fulfilling that promise. It took thousands of years because the promise to Abram is finally, completely, ultimately fulfilled in Abram's true offspring, Jesus. Like the everyday issues of our lives, we can trust Him with our eternal life. And like Abram, God makes this promise to us through a covenant so that we can see what He will do. It is the covenant that helps us recognize that God is trustworthy. Doesn't make God any more trustworthy, and yet He gives a covenant to strengthen our faith. See, a covenant says God would rather die than break His promises. And in the new covenant Jesus brings, we discover that God actually has to die in order to fulfill His promises. God can be trusted because God is trustworthy.